Hello everyone, welcome to Plumbing Game Studies, a games and philosophy podcast. I am your host, Graham Culbertson. You're about to hear the very first episode, but first I want to tell you that in my first draft I called it How to Do Things with Games, and I recorded this episode in that mode, so don't be confused when I call the podcast a different name than what you've seen in the art. This episode is about philosophy using the metaphor of plumbing. And this podcast is about philosophy using the metaphor of plumbing for games. Enjoy! Some time ago, an innocent bystander, after glancing through a copy of the philosophy journal Mind, asked me, why do philosophers talk so much about games? Do they play them a lot or something? Well, why do they? Hello everyone, welcome to How to Do Things with Games, a games and philosophy podcast. This episode is called Episode 1, Plumbing for Game Studies, and this idea of philosophy as plumbing comes from the work of Mary Midgley, who I'm using a lot in this episode, and was the source of this 1974 quote, "Why do philosophers talk so much about games?" Before we get into that, a little about me. My name is Graham Culbertson, and you may know me from such podcasts as Everyday Anarchism or A-Ideas. I'm a professor in the English and Comparative Literature Department of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and I'm part of the Critical Game Studies Initiative in that department. To put it another way, I work on the history of ideas normally, and what difference those ideas make, and lately I've been teaching and designing classes on games, so this podcast is me bringing those two things together. And I'm going to try to answer that question that Mary Midgley's non-philosopher friend, who she calls an innocent bystander, asks her. Why do philosophers talk so much about games? Which brings us to the subtitle, Games and Philosophy. The first thing you should know about this project is that I am not a philosopher, or at least I don't have a degree in philosophy. In fact, sometimes I go so far as to argue that I am against philosophy. But at the same time, the most common complaint about my classes is that they aren't about what they say they're about. If I teach a class on American literature, or writing essays, or film, or games, the students always say, there's too much philosophy in this class. This isn't a class on games, it's really a philosophy class. So how can this be? How can I be not a philosopher? And also my students say the only thing I teach is philosophy. Well, I'm going to give you a really oversimplified history of philosophy over the past 100 years to make sense of this, which will also show you where I'm coming from. For a long time in Western universities, for centuries, basically since there have been Western universities, and they're about 1,000 years old, philosophy was pretty much synonymous with knowledge. So knowledge of the natural world wasn't called science or physics. It was called natural philosophy, philosophy of the natural world. Philosophy was the mother of all knowledge, and academic fields, like what became physics or biology, for example, were subsets of natural philosophy, which was itself a subset of philosophy. We still use the word this way in our degrees. PhD stands for Doctor of Philosophy in Latin, which doesn't mean you're a philosopher, it means you're a person who knows things, which again was a synonym for philosopher back in these times. Every person with a PhD is technically a philosopher of their field. So in that general sense, every academic is a philosopher. But that's not what my students mean. Obviously, they're taking classes with other English professors who seem to be teaching classes that are not philosophy. So we need another more specialized definition of philosophy. And this will explain to you why I sometimes say I am against philosophy. In the university, again, the Western university, a new field of philosophy was created in the late 19th century and early 20th century, which we often called analytic philosophy. Analytic philosophy, and this is, again, a gross oversimplification, had a number of centers. The most important one was probably the University of Cambridge in the UK. And analytic philosophers wanted to use formal logic and mathematics to clean philosophy up, to make it make sense, to remove it from the vagueness and confusion and the mystical thinking that had given philosophy a bad name. The other word for analytic philosophy is Anglo-American philosophy, because analytic philosophy was the big winner in British and American universities. And so the philosophy departments in British and American universities are pretty much just analytic philosophy. But when the ordinary person thinks about philosophy, they probably think of some ancient Greeks like Plato and Aristotle, and then some French and German thinkers from the past 500 years. Michel de Montaigne, René Descartes, Immanuel Kant, Nietzsche, Hegel, these people. And these people still counted as philosophers in Europe. And they still had followers, and there were still philosophy departments in the 20th century doing this work parallel to analytic philosophy. This other form of philosophy, which is sometimes called continental philosophy, meaning the European continent, became very popular in the 60s and 70s in the United States, but not in philosophy departments, because it didn't count as philosophy according to the philosophy departments in the 60s and 70s. So where did it go? It went to the English department or other humanities departments. So we had these legendary French philosophers like Jacques Derrida or Michel Foucault teaching in American universities, but they were teaching in English departments or humanity departments, not in philosophy departments. And people in humanities departments read continental philosophy and taught it, but they didn't call it philosophy, which is what it would have been called in France, because there was already a philosophy department in America, and they said, no, Foucault does not count as philosophy. So they, I mean, we, although I wasn't alive then, we English professors who study philosophy called it theory or critical theory. So you can study continental philosophy in Anglo-American universities, but you can't call it philosophy. You call it something else, usually theory. And that was my minor for my Doctor of Philosophy in Literature, critical theory. And when I say I'm against philosophy, I mean what the philosophers in America call philosophy, analytic philosophy. I think I would probably count as a philosopher in France, but not in the United States. So now you might ask, why didn't I subtitle this podcast Games and Theory, or Theory of Games, instead of using this dangerous and complicated word philosophy? First of all, the term game theory was already taken, and that means something very specific in math and economics, and I didn't want to get my podcast confused with game theory. And second, both analytic philosophy and critical theory have sort of splintered and gotten mixed back together again, so I'm ready to start thinking that I might be working in that field called philosophy. Plus, analytic philosophy, which has really developed and become much less of the kind of logic puzzles that I disliked, has had some really interesting work related to games lately and in the second half of the 20th century. So for the first time in my career, I'm going to try to work in those two streams at the same time. I think the streams might be coming back together. I think maybe, just maybe, after being a theorist for the past 15 years, I might be ready to be interested in what is called philosophy. And here's the philosopher Dan Dennett with a quote about how there's kind of a middle ground between these two philosophies. He's definitely an analytic philosopher, but also he doesn't want to be the parody of an analytic philosopher. And he's talking about these two figures, satirizing them, the analytic philosopher, a logic chopper who just wants to be a mathematician, and the continental philosopher, a deep purple sage who really just wants to be like a mystic teacher. Here's this Dennett quote from his book, Intuition Pumps. "There is a time and a place in philosophy for rigorous arguments, with all the premises numbered and the inference rules named, but these do not often need to be paraded in public. We ask our graduate students to prove that they can do it in their dissertations, and some never outgrow the habit, unfortunately. And to be fair, the opposite sin of high-flown continental rhetoric, larded with literary ornament and intimations of profundity, does philosophy no favors either. If I had to choose, I'd take the hard-bitten analytic logic chopper over the deep purple sage every time. At least you can usually figure out what the logic chopper is talking about and what would count as being wrong." All right, so if he has to choose, Dennett says he would take the logic chopper. I disagree. If I have to choose, I will take the deep purple sage. But both Dennett and I want to avoid these extremes. And it seems to me that lots and lots of philosophers in both traditions are working in such similar ways that maybe it doesn't even make sense to talk about these as two separate traditions anymore. Even the people who I might want to label analytic philosophers that I'm going to talk about in this podcast, Mary Midgley, Bernard Suits, the very recent work of Tien Nguyen, they aren't analytic philosophers in that logic-chopping sense. I think we've all sort of come together. And everyone is working in response to the work of Ludwig Wittgenstein, who also may or may not have been an analytic philosopher. His first great work was Logic Chopping, and he kind of became a Deep Purple sage. And I think no one knows what to do with him, but everyone finds him interesting and exciting. But there's a little bit more to it as well when I'm thinking about philosophy as opposed to theory. It seems to me that when you think about analytic philosophy in its more logic chopping way, you're actually talking about puzzles, really a game. And I used to think analytic philosophy was a sort of useless game, but even if it is a useless game, and I guess I'm admitting that it's not, the fact that philosophers are playing a game is very interesting to me as someone who wants to study games and philosophy. Here's a quote that will make a little bit of sense of this, I think, from the philosopher Richard Rorty, who was an analytic philosophy apostate. He was trained as an analytic philosopher, but he sort of turned against analytic philosophy. And then, like Derrida and Foucault, he had to be in English and humanities departments because the philosophers decided he didn't count as a philosopher. Here's a quote from Rorty's essay, Trotsky and the Wild Orchids. "I decided that the test of philosophical truth was overall coherence, rather than deducibility from unquestioned first principles." But this didn't help much, for coherence is a matter of avoiding contradictions, and St. Thomas's advice, when you meet a contradiction, make a distinction, makes that pretty easy. As far as I could see, philosophical talent was largely a matter of proliferating as many distinctions as were needed to wriggle out of a dialectical corner. More generally, it was a matter, when trapped in such a corner, of re-describing the nearby intellectual terrain in such a way that the terms used by one's opponent would seem irrelevant, or question-begging, or jejune. I turned out to have a flair for such redescription, but I became less and less certain that developing this skill was going to make me either wise or virtuous. So Rorty doesn't use the term game, but it's obvious that he's talking about a game. He got into philosophy to do something important, to be wise or virtuous. But instead, he's just playing a game where you try to make a bunch of distinctions. And why are you making distinctions? So that you can slip out of a corner and defeat your opponent. He could be describing sumo or kabaddi. I guess sumo doesn't have corners, but kabaddi does. And done simply for its own sake, Rorty decides this game is pointless. And Rorty didn't want to play the game of philosophy pointlessly, so he left analytic philosophy. But he kept this style of redescription. He just wanted to turn it to more useful ends. So this is maybe my first big claim. Philosophy is a game with a set of rules and a certain aim. And what those rules are and what the aim is will really determine how useful your philosophy is. So one thing this podcast can do is critique philosophy as a game. But that's one of only two approaches I want to take in this podcast. That one we could call philosophy as a game. And the other one, and this is the one I'm starting with, is the philosophy of games. So I want to use the tools of philosophy to try and define and understand what games are. Then I want to take that analysis of games and turn it back on philosophy. Studying games using philosophy, I'm calling philosophy of games. Studying philosophy as a game, I'm calling philosophy as game. Going back to that Rorty quote, I'm really interested in the way that philosophy can be thought of as the search for knowledge or the quest for truth, but as a game. So this philosophy as game thing is fascinating. I've already mentioned this philosopher, T. Nguyen. In his book, Games, Art as Agency, he says very early in the book, "The rules of the game tell us to care about something, and we start caring about it. A board game tells us to care about collecting one color of token. A video game tells us to care about stomping on little mushroom people. A sport tells us to get a ball in a net. In order to achieve that cherished state of absorbed play, we let that goal occupy our consciousness for a while." And the fact that the game designer specifies goals and abilities for the player to take on, that is precisely what makes games distinctive as an art form. Now, that's the end of the Nguyen quote. I almost left that bit about the art form out because it cuts against what I'm trying to do with the rest of the quote, but I need to leave it in. I think what Nguyen is saying is that games as works of art are unusual in that they shape our agency, even though we don't care about those choices for any other reasons. We don't hate mushroom people, but we have Mario Stomp Goombas because the game wants us to. And philosophy, at least as it is practiced within institutions, has certain rules and things it wants philosophers to do. I've always resisted this aspect of analytic philosophy, just like Rorty did. But in this podcast, I also want to use Nguyen's analysis, which Nguyen has definitely turned on other things that could be considered games, like science and government, to ask what rules analytic philosophers have to follow if they are going to succeed, win the game of analytic philosophy. I think most analytic philosophers are unlikely to think of philosophy as a game this way. I'm sure I'll get a chance to ask some. But I do think this is a great way to understand philosophy and maybe even all the disciplines. To come at it from another angle, here's a thinker from the continental tradition, Foucault. And I should say, my wife suggested I name this podcast, What the Foucault Are You Playing At? Maybe I should have. Too late. It's called How to Do Things with Games. So Foucault describes truth itself as a game, which is another example of how philosophers seem to be obsessed with games. This quote from Foucault, which is from an interview in Philosophy and Social Criticism, it came out in 1984, I think right after Foucault died. And the interviewers are suggesting that Foucault is going in a new direction in his work in the 1980s. So they ask him, "We would like to know if your present philosophical research is still determined by the poles subjectivity and truth." So the question is, Foucault, are you still focused on these two binary poles, subjectivity and truth? Thinking they're saying he's doing a new thing. And Foucault answers, "In fact, that has always been my problem, even if I have expressed in different terms the framework of this thought. I have tried to discover how the human subject entered into games of truth, whether they be games of truth which take on the form of science or which refer to a scientific model, or games of truth like those that can be found in institutions or practices of control. That is the theme of my book, The Order of Things, where I've tried to see how, in scientific creation, the human subject will be defined as an individual who talks, who works, who lives. It is in my courses at the Collège de France that I tried to outline this problem in its generality." Okay, I don't have time to unpack this amazing idea. The idea that Foucault's entire career was about games of truth. Suffice to say, you'll be hearing more about this in the future of this podcast, the idea of games of truth. And if science is a game of truth, as Foucault suggests, then so is philosophy. It also means that the rules of the game, whether you call it philosophy or science or economics or anything else, really determine what you get. Going back to T. Nguyen's idea that the game tells us what we want, and when we are playing that game, we are going to do that thing. But that's going to have to come later. The first series of episodes in this podcast is going to be the other thing. Not philosophy as a game, but a philosophy of games. Because I've noticed, in the few years that I've been working on game studies, that there doesn't really seem to be a consensus on what games are and how they should be studied. We have this problem too in the field of literature. We don't have a consensus. But actually, we have so many paradigms in schools. The problem isn't no good paradigm to understand literature, but many, many different and competing schools and paradigms. And game studies, I think, is so young that it has few, if any, fully developed ways of thinking. And the ones that do exist seem to be focused on video games, even though games are so much older than video games. And I think the field needs to take a step back and just build up a philosophical infrastructure before just plunging ahead with analysis of what Call of Duty means or what the meaning of Civilization V is. To put it another way, game studies could use some plumbing. I'm taking this idea of philosophical plumbing from Mary Midgley, who I opened this podcast episode with a 1974 quote from. This is from a 1992 article called Philosophical Plumbing. She mentions in that article that she's been using this metaphor of philosophical plumbing for a while, but this is her fullest statement of it. Here's Midgley. "Plumbing and philosophy are both activities that arise because elaborate cultures like ours have, beneath their surface, a fairly complex system which is usually unnoticed, but which sometimes goes wrong." In both cases, this can have serious consequences. Each system supplies vital needs for those who live above it. Each is hard to repair when it does go wrong, because neither of them was ever consciously planned as a whole. There have been many ambitious attempts to reshape both of them, but existing complications are usually too widespread to allow a completely new start. Neither system ever had a single designer who knew exactly what needs it would have to meet. Instead, both have grown imperceptibly over the centuries and are constantly being altered piecemeal to suit changing demands. As the ways of life above them have branched out, both are therefore now very intricate. When trouble arises, specialized skill is needed if there is to be any hope of locating it and putting it right. All right, that's the end of the quote. I must admit, I'm a little skeptical about this notion of specialized skill. I'm always skeptical, this is some of my resistance to analytic philosophy, about the idea that philosophers are experts like plumbers. But the other idea, that our societies run on ideas that sort of underpin everything, even though most people don't think about them, is really at the heart of my thinking. I've usually used this quote from John Maynard Keynes at the end of his book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, to get at this idea, but I like Midgley's version of it better. Let me give you the Keynes quote and explain why I prefer Midgley's. Here's Keynes. "The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood." Okay, stopping and breaking in there. Sounds great. These ideas are very powerful, just like plumbing really matters. Although actually, there's something different between really mattering and being powerful. Keynes goes on, "Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences are usually the slaves of some defunct economist." Okay, I think Midgley and Keynes are saying roughly the same thing in that people are not noticing these ideas, and those ideas are important and powerful. Society is running on them. But Keynes has this tone. He's talking about power. He's talking about slavery. He is suggesting that we are all controlled by the political philosophers of 50 years ago. This is a really heightened, politicized idea. He mentions good and evil later in the quote. There's something scary, and I think wrong, about the idea that the philosophers are in charge of us, as opposed to the plumbers, who are necessary to the functioning of our society, but their work is by no means making them the boss of all of us. So I think Midgley's metaphor for philosophy is way better. Yes, ideas matter, and people are using ideas that they didn't come up with, that were bequeathed to them from the past or from experts. And sometimes those ideas need to be changed, and people notice. But people are not the slaves of economists and philosophers. So let's use plumbing as our metaphor instead. Our ideas are our infrastructure, a system of connected tools that make our thinking possible, but they have become invisible and they were built over time and need to be fixed. They are not our masters. And that means philosophers can be plumbers, valuable craftspeople who help make our world work. And in this case, I'm trying to look at the philosophers who can do some intellectual infrastructure for games. Here's Midgley's example of how philosophy as plumbing works. From there, she goes on to the key ideas that she wants to unclog that are related to the self and social contract theory and exploitation. We don't need that, just this metaphor. Here's Midgley. "Time and again, in the past, when conceptual schemes have begun to work badly, someone has contrived to suggest a change that shifts the blockage, allowing thought to flow where it is needed. Once this has happened, the bystanders tend to heave deep sighs and say, 'Aha, of course, I knew all along. Why didn't I happen to say it before?' Sometimes, indeed, they think they have done so." That's the end of the quote. And again, I'm still a little skeptical of this idea of the philosophers as so superior at thinking to ordinary people that ordinary people are helpless. Not helpless in everything, not slaves, but helpless the way you are when your toilet is clogged and there's nothing you can do about it. But leaving aside that suspicion of expertise that I have, this is the side of me that is, quote, anti-philosophy, I think this metaphor of plumbing for game studies is so important. Regular people, people who are not in game studies, maybe they don't think they're worried about what a game is, in the same way that maybe they are worried about the role of money and the value of work and what it means to exploit or oppress someone. But at least on the internet, I've noticed that people do really love arguing about what games are and what they mean. So these are ideas that people care about. That's why we have this new field of game studies. But the people who are working in game studies seem to me to be philosophizing on their own, just making it up as they go along. And again, Midgley has something to say about this in her Philosophical Plumbing essay when she talks about how this is what happens when you try and work through ideas without a field to support you. Ought we all to be able to do this ourselves, each on our own, on a do-it-yourself basis? This attractive idea probably lies at the heart of British anti-intellectualism. We do sometimes manage this do-it-yourself philosophizing, and there is, of course, a great deal to be said for trying. But it is exceedingly hard to see where we need to start. Indeed, as I mentioned, often we find it hard to imagine that anything definite is wrong with our concepts at all. So that's where I think we stand right now in terms of games and philosophy for the purposes of game studies. Everyone is doing it themselves. That's what I have been doing, philosophizing mostly on my own, with a few conversations with grad students in my department and reading some Wittgenstein. And then I had a conversation with T. Nguyen for my other podcast, and I read his book, and I realized that he is creating a philosophical infrastructure for thinking about games. He's not the only one working right now on this, but he's definitely the best I've found. And he pointed me to this book called The Grasshopper by Bernard Suits, which made me realize there's some plumbing there as well. And Nguyen is also calling on fields that do have some good plumbing. Science and technology studies, which Mary Midgley was one of the greatest practitioners of, and aesthetic theory. So this system is being built little by little, piece by piece, the pipes are coming together, but I think there is still a lot of work to do to adapt these ideas for games, to recover the parts of philosophy that are about games that have been forgotten, and to examine the philosophical infrastructure that is springing up with all of these do-it-yourself game philosophers in game studies. Which brings me back round to Ludwig Wittgenstein. Like I said, when I was doing my own do-it-yourself philosophizing of games, I was starting with Wittgenstein, and he is the perfect embodiment of everything I want in this podcast. He explains his philosophy using games, he provides a philosophy of games, and he is clearly playing philosophy as a game. He is also, in some ways, against the very idea of this podcast because he is generally taken to say that there simply can't be any plumbing around games, or maybe, honestly, any plumbing around anything. Wittgenstein says that you simply can't define games or do much thinking about them or anything without it all falling apart. At least that's what people say, Wittgenstein says. As Mary Midgley puts it in The Game Game, this is her article from the 70s, Wittgenstein uses games as the prime example of something which we cannot define. A set of things so various as to have no element in common, linked only by a meandering string of family resemblances with no underlying unity at all. That's the end of the Midgley quote, and this is, I think, really not fair to Wittgenstein. Although it does reflect the crude version of Wittgenstein that you get from people who don't actually read Wittgenstein. And Midgley even knows this because she writes, "Here, as always, Wittgenstein's actual position would certainly turn out to be much more subtle and interesting than what other people have made of it." So that's where I want to start. Not with someone's sloppy, half-remembered thing that Wittgenstein said about games, but actually trying to understand his subtle and interesting position. So don't worry. This podcast is not going to be just me talking. It's mostly going to be interviews. And the first person I'm interviewing is Jon Arjanta. I'm sorry, Jon. I have no idea how to pronounce your name. I did my best. He'll fix it when he comes on the show. Who is on the record as saying that Wittgenstein does not say that we can't define a game. That will be episode 2 of this Philosophical Plumbing module. And I'll follow that up with more episodes discussing other people who I think we can use as we're building this philosophical plumbing. The most obvious ones are Johann Huizinga, Roger Caillois, and Bernard Suits. Besides, of course, Mary Midgley herself. That will be Module 1, Philosophical Plumbing for Game Studies. After that, who knows what will happen? You'll probably hear from my grad students at some point. We'll definitely have to talk about how philosophy is a game, philosophy as game. I will want to talk about sports and why C.L.R. James defended sports when Trotsky was attacking them, and why Umberto Eco hated soccer, games in science fiction, like the games they play in Star Trek The Next Generation, and of course the Ian M. Banks novel, The Player of Games. All of these will come along eventually. Please let me know if you have any pitches for future episodes. I'd love to hear them. My email address is graham.culbertson@unc.edu. I mean, if you can't remember how to spell that, you can just Google me and the phrase UNC and you'll find me in my email address. Thanks for listening, everyone. Remember to keep doing things with games or asking, what the Foucault are you playing at? Either one works for me.